Like most Americans, I don't believe that students should be treated differently based on their race.
In the winter of 2015, Abigail Fisher spoke outside the U.S. Supreme Court. Fisher was at the center of the most prominent college admissions case to reach the Supreme Court in a very long time. Fisher v. University of Texas.
Hopefully, this case will end racial classifications and preferences in admissions at the University of Texas.
Fisher is white, and when she applied to UT Austin in 2008, she was denied admission. Her lawyers argued that this decision had everything to do with race.
Well, that's what we're seeking in this case, Mr. Chief Justice, a level playing field for Abby Fisher.
The Supreme Court first heard Fisher's case in 2012 and then again in 2016. Both times they ruled that affirmative action is constitutional as long as colleges adhere to a set of guidelines when using race as a factor in admissions.
In order for judicial review to be meaningful, a university must make a showing that its plan is narrowly tailored to achieve the only interest that this court has approved in this context.
Anthony Kennedy delivered the court's majority opinion back in 2013.
The benefits of a student body diversity that encompasses a broad array of qualifications and characteristics of which racial or ethnic origin is but a single, though important, element.
When the court upheld its decision 3 years later, then-President Barack Obama voiced his support.
I'm pleased that the Supreme Court upheld the basic notion that diversity is an important value in our society, and that this country should provide a high-quality education to all our young people, regardless of their background.
But today, there are signs of shifting attitudes about the use of race-based affirmative action. Earlier this month, the Education and Justice Departments withdrew several Obama-era guidances that support affirmative action. And in a lawsuit expected to go to trial this fall, a group of Asian American students rejected from Harvard are alleging that the university's admissions policies unfairly disadvantaged Asian American students on the whole, while giving a leg up to other minority groups. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today, a look at how affirmative action works and whether or not it can survive.
One of the greatest tragedies in this country is to attack the only systemic remedy that we have to stimulate racial equity and racial diversity.
That's Glenn Singleton, a former director of Western Regional Admissions for the University of Pennsylvania.
Affirmative action has had extraordinary value, and I would not be sitting here with you if there weren't an affirmative action process.
Today, Glenn runs Courageous Conversations, an organization that consults with companies about racial equity, including our co-producer, WNYC. And he described how the admissions process works.
We would literally spend all day as the admissions staff reading applications. And our applications are quite comprehensive. We do a holistic look. So it's not only a look at their scores and grades and things like that, but the applicants write essays. They have recommendations. All of that's taken into account. Ultimately, we go to committee. And in that committee, the director will present the applicant and we'll talk about the applicant's qualifications. And as a committee, we'll decide whether that applicant moves into one of three categories. That applicant would be admitted. That applicant would be waitlisted, meaning that we would figure out over the course of the period whether we're going to admit that student or not, or the applicant would be denied admission.
Can you give us a sense for how and when race factored in, and if race factored into the admissions process when you were a part of it?
Absolutely. The race does factor into the admission process. We recognize that in order to bring a racially diverse class to an institution that has a history of not bringing racially diverse classes, we have to be affirmative in that process. We are affirmative in many components of the class, though, I should say. So oftentimes there's a lot of pressure around the race aspect of affirmative action. But to sort of see that children whose parents went to the institution bring value to the institution, to see that admitting students who come from families that have enormous resources to provide to the institution, they bring some kind of dimension to the class, to see that a faculty staff children, you know, who are professors at the institution, their students are looked at in an affirmative way as well. Athletes are looked at in an affirmative way. And each of these groups of students are believed to contribute some dimension to the class.
When we hone in on race as the problem, and I think that's what we'll, you know, we see a lot of that playing out in people's discomfort with race-based affirmative action, rarely do we put the same lens on the majority white students who benefit from legacy admissions. Are legacies even fair?
I mean, the word fair is probably the most interesting word that you're using, right? Because what's fair here? I'm not sure that as an admissions director, I was looking for what's fair. What I was looking for was what is going to bring about the best learning experience for the students who come to the University of Pennsylvania. And as an African-American male who went to Penn and found myself having to often teach my white friends and faculty what it means to not only navigate the university, but many experiences that are racially loaded, this part and contribution, I believe, is quite necessary. And so I can very easily explain why we need to diversify by race. When I look at the legacy factor, okay, sometimes I can't explain that. But what I do know is that when the institution is generous to the sons and daughters of its alumni, then those alumni tend to be more generous to the institution.
One of the issues that has come up is there's been an argument in favor of class-based affirmative action, if you will, and it's a complicated topic. But just in terms of what you're saying, if that lens shifts to focusing on lower-income student admissions, for example, will they be valued as much as the ones that you're describing who literally bring money to the table?
Yeah, it's quite predictable in this country that there is this debate between race and class. And I find that telling because there is a difference in being poor and black in the United States and being poor and white. And both of those poor students will bring an understanding about poverty. What is the distinction is that that poor student of color can not only speak to navigating to excellence, which is where we've admitted that student because of their economic circumstances, but they can also talk about how those dynamics of systemic institutional racism in our society have also been barriers for them that they've been somehow able to navigate and still show excellence.
I want to go back to the case of Abigail Fisher in Texas. And that case has now been settled. But part of what Abigail Fisher and many other people who take issue with affirmative action, there's a sense that their spots have been taken because of affirmative action, that
right.
Their rightful seat at the table, if you will, has been taken away from them in favor of an, and I will, undeserving, quote unquote, black or brown student.
Correct. And so, you know, as a former admissions director, my heart goes out to all students whose dreams are shattered when they're not admitted, right? And I had this conversation on national television about the problem of particularly white parents not preparing their students for the reality that there is no spot that is their spot. Okay? And this process, by definition, is a selective process. And selective means that you can have qualification, which means you're eligible, but you might not be selected. Okay, and so I think the nation has to reflect on the fact that millions of students are denied admission every year. Abigail Fisher never had a spot at the University of Texas, and that's where the breakdown was, right? So no one took her spot. No one takes anyone's spot. Those spots have to be allocated to the most diverse class that will get at the challenges facing the country, facing the state of Texas, facing the communities. And so how we find people who actually bring that kind of understanding and bring that kind of ability to do the work. And I don't believe that, by and large, we're admitting anybody who's not ready to do the work. The question is, can they navigate the environment, including a whole lot of people at the institution who believe that they shouldn't be there?
If affirmative action is ruled unconstitutional, what would you see being the biggest change?
This is such a complex thing that I feel the United States is trying to move to a Supreme Court decision, when in reality, we need to allow this to be a part of the dialogue and the conversation right now. And we need to allow for people to dig into this and really make meaning of it. And if, in fact, the Supreme Court rules affirmative action illegal, then I know that as an admissions director then, and as I could picture myself in that seat today, I'm still going to be able to figure out how to diversify my class.
Glenn Singleton is the founder of Courageous Conversations and former director of Western Regional Admissions for the University of Pennsylvania. Glenn, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what do students think about the affirmative action policies that could affect their chances of getting into their dream school? I asked three of them. Diana Brown is going into her senior year at Cornell.
I think when I was applying, what made my application stand out, aside from basic things like having the right test scores and having performed decently well in high school, was at the time the college that I'm in, which I'm in the hotel program at Cornell, required in-person interviews. And so I do think that kind of made my application stand out. I'm also a legacy within my school. Just my mom attended the school before me. So I don't know the degree to which that is considered. Obviously, like, the process isn't completely transparent, but that was kind of part of my process of applying, was putting down that I was a legacy.
Bernita Haynes is a lawyer who graduated from Drury University in 2006 and the University of Iowa Law School in 2013.
I was one of three African-American students entering into my freshman class in 2002 at Drury University. That alone kind of confirmed for me that being African-American had a lot of impact on my acceptance. I also, in my essay for admission to Drury University, I remember speaking about being from an African-American family, from a poor family, a single-parent family, and how that had impacted my decision to want to go to college. That's something I've always owned and been very eager to sort of discuss and highlight about myself, because I do feel it's a really critical part of my evolution as a person.
Our last guest wants to remain anonymous, so I'm just going to call her by her initials, JC. And she says she was not admitted to her first choice, Harvard.
I'm Asian American. I'm an immigrant who came to the U.S. when I was in first grade. I grew up in a lower middle class household. My mom was a public school teacher. She scrimped and saved her way to move me into a tiny apartment in a wealthy school district, so at least I can go to a good school. I had a perfect SAT score, so a 1600 out of 1600. I did 2 summers of research at an Ivy League medical school. I was on the county math team. Despite all that, I got waitlisted from Harvard. Meanwhile, from my high school, there were 2 people who got in with much lower credentials who were athletes. Their SAT scores were respectively 1350 and 1360 versus my 1600. One of the 2 athletes was also a legacy. His dad and his older brother had both gone to Harvard. It was extremely disappointing to me to run into something that was so blatantly unequal and so blatantly unmeritocratic. And my goal now, in addition to my other plans to make the world a better place, is also to make sure this doesn't happen to anyone else again.
Bernita picked up the conversation on the point that JC last made about whether we should talk about athletes when we talk about race-based admissions.
I would like to pinpoint that I think conflating university admissions policies that prefer athletes with university admissions policies that take into account the racial background of a student is really problematic. Those are two separate kinds of discussions to be had. I mean, I can definitely understand why someone would have an issue with athletes being privileged over other students with higher test scores and things of that nature. I do think that conflating that with race-based admissions policies does a disservice to the discussion about affirmative action.
Diana, what are your thoughts? Because you mentioned you are a legacy student, and that may have played a role in your getting into Cornell. And the reason why we're including legacies in this conversation is because the majority of legacy students do happen to be white students.
It's definitely a tricky topic to discuss. I totally understand where JC is coming from. That is incredibly frustrating to have worked so hard, especially given your background and had the scores that you had, and to have not gotten into the top school of your choice. Like, I can totally see, and it's hard for me to say that I don't like the legacy system completely, because I do think it could have had something to do with me being admitted to my school, and I do like having that connection with my mom, who also went to the same school, but I can see how it would present an unfair bias towards more privileged families and skew admissions.
I just actually, before convening this roundtable with the three of you, I spoke to a former admissions counselor at University of Pennsylvania. And one thing that did come up and continues to come up is whether or not someone can take away a seat from somebody else. And JC, you seem to think that that happened to you.
I think if you think about what colleges are, the mission of a college is mostly education. Just like the mission of the World Cup is mostly soccer, and the mission of the Olympics is mostly sports, and the mission of making a movie is mostly acting or directing. For example, when I was like younger, you know, I had like a secret dream of being a movie star. But it's not my main thing I'm spending my time on. So I can't just go to Steven Spielberg and say, hey, you know, you should cast me your next blockbuster as the main lead role because I love to act and I bring intellectual diversity to the cast, right? That doesn't fly. And just likewise, school is mostly about academics. And so if you can't do a good job in school, why should you get into Harvard? That just sounds like it's just not very related to playing sports.
Well, and I also think that, you know, the big question I think that I'm trying to understand from the three of you is who is benefiting from these policies, particularly if we get rid of race-based affirmative action, which they've done in Michigan and they've done that in California. Is there a way to focus on class?
Yeah, I would just like to jump in and say that in this country, you cannot legitimately separate class from race. Race really determines your class background in large part in this country. I would also say that it is a reality in some respects that at elite universities, the people of color who are admitted are probably by and large from upper middle class backgrounds more so than lower middle class backgrounds. As I would say about any public policy, nothing is perfect and there's always room for improvement. I always like to point folks to an essay by one of my law professors, Professor Angela Onwuachi Willick, who's now a dean at Boston University. But she has a couple of really interesting, I believe, proposed solutions to kind of get at this particular skewed sort of problem at the elite universities. And one solution was to sort of include as a requirement an essay where students from diverse backgrounds, they submit an essay about their racial background and ancestral heritage to the extent that they know it, and how that has helped shape their identity, whether they want that background to even be considered in the admissions process, how it can add to the diversity of the college environment. And she really suggests that this is a way to get at the university's intentions around diversity.
So yeah. We got one solution from Bernita. We're coming up on the end of our segment. I want to hear one solution from JC. And Diane, I'll give you a couple minutes to think about your proposed solution. Go ahead, JC.
So I have another solution. So when California got rid of affirmative action through Proposition, they came up with a better solution, I think. And what they did was they, I do realize that class and race are linked, But through a lot of class variables, you can also account for, you know, disadvantaged African-Americans, for example. Richard Sanders at UCLA Law School had a system where he looked at parents' income, parents' assets, because we know that African-Americans have much lower assets than white Americans due to histories of discrimination and so on. And you can look at other variables. And the sum effect of those variables was that UCLA was able to admit diversity people who were disadvantaged and who also really succeeded.
Diane, I want to hear from you.
I think something's got to give. I think the system itself has a lot of problems. I do think it kind of comes down to looking at students as an entirety when they're coming into colleges and kind of having perhaps the admissions process be a bit more complex. It's hard to do when you have such a high number of students applying at once. But I do think there has to be something else implemented, because even if we just take away kind of all programs and that kind of attempt to create more diverse college campuses and just have it based on merit, if just that merit is test scores alone and you just have the top test scores, I don't necessarily that's going to make for the most complex and interesting and diverse group of individuals at a given college.
I want to add something that I've sort of heard subtexts of both in this conversation and also by reading comments online. And it is this idea that Asian Americans are only good at taking tests and getting good grades and they're not good at anything else. And I think that's a highly problematic kind of stereotype.
I would agree with that as well. I think that's a very pernicious stereotype, and it definitely needs to be upended. I would completely agree.
And it sounds like a lot of what we've been discussing today is really rooted in stereotypes, right? And a lot of the issues that we face when it comes to affirmative action, unfortunately, continue to be complicated and very much connected to our difficult American history. Diana Brown is going into her senior year at Cornell. Bernita Haynes is a lawyer who graduated from Drury University in 2006 and the University of Iowa Law School in 2013. And JC graduated about 10 years ago from a top-tier university. I want to thank the three of you for having such a robust and interesting conversation about a difficult topic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.